She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice and I'm here with...
Elizabeth, sadly not in the same location.
Yeah, I just was going to say, not in the same location. This time we're doing it the old way again, which is via the interwebs. I mean,
it feels like the old-fashioned way because, like, this is how we've been doing it all along. Yeah. But honestly, the fact that we can use technology to do this across continents is pretty not old-fashioned.
It's not very old-fashioned, but to us, it's kind of the old way of doing it. So Elizabeth is back in the States again. I'm still in Vienna. How are you doing in the States, Elizabeth?
It's hot.
Do you miss Vienna already?
I do miss Vienna, though I love having air conditioning, so it's a toss-up.
Oh, yes. I can imagine that, because it's like 30, I think 6 or 7 degrees now. So it's much hotter than it was when you were here. Because, like, the heat wave is in full, like, it's full here now. I think tomorrow's going to be the hottest day. So, yeah, I can imagine that air conditioning would feel very good right now.
It's amazing. Yeah. But it's totally anti what we're going to talk about today, which is ecofeminism.
Exactly. Because air conditioning is not good for our ecosystem.
Not at all.
Not at all. But it's sometimes good for us. If it's hot.
It makes me feel more human. So.
Okay. So, just like the episode we did on sex-positive feminism last time, or even more so, this episode is only a very short introduction to ecofeminism. The topic is very complex. Obviously, there are so many different theories and theorists and types of activism and academic writing and debates that we cannot possibly fit everything into one episode. So, what we'll do is we'll introduce you to certain subjects, introduce some thinkers, some debates, some strands of ecofeminist thinking. But, you know, I think it's not comprehensive, and it's more like, it's more like grounds for your own research than a comprehensive overview, I would say.
Yeah, it's kind of a mini introduction and things to think about. We'll have some sources for you to peruse at your leisure in the show notes on the website. But we also, you know, we'll mention a lot of books from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s through to today that you might want to check out if you want to understand more about kind of the origins of ecofeminism and the direction it's taking now and the intersection of ecofeminism with other types of feminism.
Let's start at the beginning. What is ecofeminism, Liz? Tell us.
That's a great question.
Tell us and everything about it.
It's a great question. A lot of people are going to say ecofeminism starts in the 60s and 70s. I'm going to go back a little further, mostly because I am a scholar of the 19th century. And yeah, that's why. We often think about the roots of ecofeminism in second wave feminism. Susan Mann has suggested that as environmentalism became prominent in the late 19th century, however, it intersected with first wave feminism. So the environmentalism that we see in the 19th century really kind of, and the feminism, they do have an influence on what we do in second wave feminism. And it's really kind of the start here. So in her 2011 article, Pioneers of U.S. Ecofeminism and Environmental Justice, she states that, quote, environmentalism emerged as a prominent new social concern in the United States in the late 19th century as a reaction to how urban industrial areas were becoming overcrowded, smog-choked, and disease-ridden. The, quote, closing of the frontier in the late 1800s also generated fear that the vast lands of the public domain were being looted, polluted, and destroyed by commercial interests such as the railroad, timber, and mining companies. Think about what's going on in the United States right now with oil pipelines, and it gives you a sense of what was going on in late 19th century U.S. in terms of plundering the lands, using them for our own use and not saving them, which is how we ended up getting the National Park Service, was a way of protecting those lands from being plundered. And now in the United States, we're thinking about screwing over the National Park Service and selling off the lands to private companies. But I digress.
Wow.
So anyway, Susan Mann also argues that while some environmental activists focused on cleaning up the more densely populated areas of the nation, others focused on conserving and preserving the pristine wilderness. So we have this issue of environmental catastrophes going on in urban areas and simultaneously preserving the wilderness. And these are kind of two strains of environmental issues going on in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Environmental activism during this era was spearheaded by the progressive movement, and the vast majority of these progressive reformers were white middle-class men and women who were simultaneously sought two goals: to use state power to curb the excesses of giant corporations, and to use civic action to improve the harsher features of social life that had been ushered in by industrialization. So these are a lot of the same women who fought for women's and children's rights in factories and at home, as well as first wave feminists who fought for women's right to vote.
Yeah.
Moreover, Mann points out that the intersection of race and class were essential in this early movement because the urban environmental problems that were being addressed by these activists primarily impacted people of color, yes, individuals in poverty, working classes, and other oppressed.
Yeah.
And then she points out a few women who were really instrumental as pioneers of ecofeminism and environmental justice. Women such as Mary Austin, Jane Addams, Mary McDowell, Emma Goldman, Rose Schneiderman, Crystal Eastman, and Ida Wells Barnett, and Lugenia Hope. And these were activists and advocates for women's rights and environmental concerns of marginalized people. But this is kind of more social movement stuff, anti-industrialization that we see in the 19th century. And we often don't think that this has like much of a connection with our contemporary understanding of ecofeminism, but it really does.
It does, yeah. And also even in the beginnings of the whole thing, you know, given the fact that women were for the longest time in history and still are the ones that have to take care of children and raise children, it kind of makes sense that they were also the ones who had kind of this long-term perspective of what world do I want my child to live in, you know? And
absolutely,
I think the protection of the environment is a part of that. And this is also something that later on, I think we will get into that, is something that ecofeminism is criticized for, again, kind of portraying women as the ones who are like the caretakers of the environment, and also this kind of essentialist idea of women as being closer to nature. But I think you could also look at it from the perspective of not a reproduction. It's not a reproduction of like an essentialist idea, but it's a fact of life that women are given that role in a patriarchal society. So it makes sense that they have this perspective.
Yeah. If we tie this back to our discussion of sex positive feminism, where what is the goal of feminism? And it is to, in some ways, expose patriarchy, but also, you know, take it apart, hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
And understand the ways that social structures, like continually reproduce this oppression of women, of people of oppressed classes.
Yeah.
To look at how the environment fits into that, and how women are, you know, oftentimes in a position to be able to speak to that, particularly when it comes to, you know, seeing how urbanization, how industrialization impacts their families. Yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it. It's also, you know, ecofeminism is in some ways, I don't want to say anti-capitalist, but it exposes the potential pitfalls of capitalism and the way that it can, if left without a conscience, it can destroy the environment and the world around us.
I will talk a bit about the capitalist aspect later on, but yeah, just a side note.
So the ecofeminism we know today emerged from the 60s and 70s alongside the anti-nuclear proliferation movement and the beginnings of green political activism. And I would say that a lot of the Green Party movements that we see in political activism in the 60s really emerge out of the 68er movement, particularly in Europe. That's not to say that there isn't a lot of environmentalism going on prior to that, but really, I would say politically, the Green Parties have their roots in this kind of 68er movement. So happy anniversary, 68ers. It's really difficult to define really one strain of ecofeminism, but the general concept of ecofeminism relates environmental damage and exploration to women's exploitation and lack of empowerment. So in the article on Bustle that I read, and which we'll link to in the show notes, they quote Dr. Mary Meller, academic and author of the book Feminism and Ecology, who wrote that ecofeminism is a movement that sees a connection between the exploitation and degradation of the natural world and the subordination and oppression of women. It emerged in the mid-70s alongside second wave feminism and the green movement. Ecofeminism brings together elements of the feminist and green movements while at the same time offering a challenge to both. It takes from the green movement a concern about the impact of human activities on the non-human world, and from the feminists the view of humanity as gendered in ways that subordinate and exploit and oppress women. So that's the overall idea. It's not actually necessarily one movement, and instead it's more like a group of concepts and thoughts that emerged as part of a cultural moment in the 1970s, just like feminism more generally.
Which is also why it's so difficult to talk about it in one episode, you know?
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, we could talk about... Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to say, as we said, it's just an introduction. We could talk about ecofeminism for 20 episodes and we would have enough material to talk about. It's just really a very short introduction.
Absolutely.
I actually worked on like my part until like the second of the recording because I'm not even finished now. I'm just going to tell you what I've researched up to this point because it doesn't end. So there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, you could definitely go down a rabbit hole with a lot of academic theories and a lot of political theory about any topic. And ecofeminism is no exception.
Yeah.
So Dr. Richard Twine, who's written on animal studies, feminist bioethics, and the relationship between politics and food, think veganism, which we will talk about later, explains that ecofeminism's varying strains are like differing accounts that wove together a perceived interconnection between the domination of women and nature. So one form of ecofeminism takes it very literally, saying that women are viewed in the same way as natural resources, something to be taken, plundered, or used. And some call this perspective radical ecofeminism, that women and the environment are exploited in the same way by the same patriarchal dominating forces who are seen as creating order and deriving value from the quote-unquote chaotic or natural things like women and forests. I just want to say, like, the essentialism of defining women as natural and chaotic is, number one, not new, but it kills me that it's still a thing.
What do you mean? Do you mean like the essentialism of this type of ecofeminist thought? Or do you mean like...
No, I mean generally. Like people seeing women as irrational or chaotic or having wandering wombs and influenced by the moon and not like rational beings.
Oh, God.
It pisses me off.
Okay.
But anyway.
So, yeah. I just wanted to add two things. The first thing is that... You know, this essentialism, I think like the ecofeminism that we're just talking about criticizes that essentialism more than it.
Yes.
It's not like a blind repetition of that essentialism. And then secondly, so was it last week? I think last week we had the blood moon thing, like the lunar eclipse in Europe. And the shit that people post on social media about how this is a moment for especially women to kind of reconnect to their with Mother Nature, right? It's always Mother Nature. It just made me so tired. Then also, like, there's this one, I'm not going to name names now, but there's this one very influential blogger in Austria who just keeps posting things about menstruation and how it's connected to the moon, and how now that there was this blood moon, everyone's menstruating, and how this is a moment for women to kind of celebrate the natural femininity and whatever. So, yep.
I mean, to be fair, women's cycles are on like a lunar, you know, 28-day-ish cycle. And so they are affected by, you know, they do coincide with whatever. Whatever. But yes.
But yes.
All of what you said.
Yeah, it's just like this whole construction of women as somehow more natural beings than men, and the whole construction of nature that is at the grounds of all of that. It's just everything about it pisses me off, and I could go on about it for hours. It's just such bullshit. And it's such sexist bullshit too, and people don't realize it. And it pisses me off even more when it's like people that should be, I don't know, more enlightened than that. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, so radical ecofeminism basically says, you know, that patriarchal dominating forces are supposedly creating order out of the chaotic and natural, which is women and forests, right? So like they see that they should have dominion over them because they are more rational and ordered. Bullshit. Some radical ecofeminists also take the same position about animal welfare, saying that animals are being treated are being unfairly exploited by current power structures in a way that harms the environment too. And I think if we look at factory farming, we can probably see evidence of this. Probably.
It's a possibility.
Yes. So there's another perspective, and this is cultural ecofeminism, that makes the link between nature and women to be empowering, picturing the female gender as uniquely connected to the environment and natural processes through things like menstruation and birth control.
There we go.
Or sorry, birth control. Childbirth
control.
No. Oh gosh, I love that in my mind when I see the word childbirth, the first thing that comes out of my mouth is birth control.
The first thing when you see the word child is contraception, contraception. Abortion, contraception.
Anyway, so this perspective suggests that when it comes to feeling the real damage of environmental harm and doing something about it, women are better placed to take action because we're more connected to the earth, Mother Gaia, whatever.
So that's the more essentialist perspective.
That is the more essentialist perspective. And that they often call that cultural ecofeminism instead of radical ecofeminism.
Yeah.
So some of the earliest feminist scholars of ecofeminism were Rachel Carson, an American marine biologist and author of the book Silent Spring from 1962, which aroused a really heart-touching voice of conscience in protest against the pollution and degradation of nature. And her book really sowed the seeds for the modern ecology movement that culminated in the first U.S. Earth Day in 1970. So Earth Day, we have Rachel Carson to thank for that. French feminist Françoise, I'm terrible with French, Daubon, there, because there's an E at the end, so I would pronounce the N, Daubon, has been credited with coining the word ecofeminism in 1974 in her book Feminism or Death, which the translation is from 1980. And her book is defined as a wake-up call for all women to lead an ecological revolution to save planet Earth. Inestra King was one of the conference organizers of the ecofeminist conferences in March 1980 entitled Women and Life on Earth, a conference on ecofeminism in the 80s. Very original title.
Listen.
I mean, it's a struggle coming up with like pithy titles for academic research. Yeah, I get it.
We've got the same problem.
Yeah. At this conference, the connections between feminism and militarization, healing, and ecology were explored. King wrote that ecofeminism is about connectedness and wholeness of theory and practice. It asserts the special strength and integrity of every living thing. For us, the snail darter is to be considered side by side with the community's need for water. So, you know, understanding how our need for water impacts the animals that are living in that water.
Okay, what is a snail darter?
I would assume it's a type of frog. but I don't know that for certain.
Okay.
You want to Google that for me?
I'm going to Google that for you while you talk.
Wait, a snail darter. Oh, okay. So there was apparently a controversy when they were creating a dam on the Tennessee River. And the snail darter is an endangered species. And it's not going to tell me what kind of... Oh, snail darter. Wait, there we go. It is a type of fish.
It's a fish. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
It's a small fish.
It's a small fish.
Okay.
Okay, so... damming a river for our water needs, we have to understand how that impacts the animals that live in that water. The porpoise side by side with the appetite for tuna. So the fact that dolphins and porpoises are getting caught in the fishermen's nets for tuna fishermen, like, we have to understand that our desire to have tuna is directly impacting other animals. And the creatures it may fall on with Skylab. So Skylab is like a international space station-y kind of lab. It's going to fall to the Earth. It's going to impact animals when it comes to the Earth. Does our research that we're doing, does it trump, for lack of a better word, the life of the animals that are going to be impacted, possibly killed, when this satellite comes back to Earth.
Okay.
So she goes on to say, we are a women-identified movement, and we believe we have a special work to do in these imperiled times. We see the devastation of the Earth and her beings by the corporate warriors and the threat of nuclear annihilation by the military warriors as feminist concerns. It is the masculinist mentality which would deny us our right to our own bodies and our own sexuality, and which depends on multiple systems of dominance and state power to have its way. There are good things there in what she said. And this is, you know, this is where we go back and say, we can't throw out everything that second wave feminism has for us. There are good things there.
And there's very problematic things.
There are very problematic things.
There were a few moments when you quoted this part of her writing where I was like, maybe not anymore.
Exactly. Like, are we simple? I mean, we can't say that the only people who are eco-feminists are women.
Yeah.
Or even women identified. Like, there are male identified eco-feminists.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but again, like, it's a product of its time. It's a product of the conference that was going on. And we maybe should pull out the things that are productive.
Yeah.
And understand that those are the things that are useful for our understanding of ecofeminism today. And, you know, ignore and, you know, understand that we've moved on from this idea of, like, masculinist mentality / you know, women identified movement.
Well, I think, I mean, I think it is. I mean, there's a difference between man and masculinist, right? So I would agree that it's a masculinist mentality. It doesn't mean that it's kind of it doesn't mean that it's a masculine or male mentality, right?
Sure.
So there's a difference here. What I also have a problem with, apart from the women identified movement thing, is this uncritical reproduction or you know, this idea that the repetition of the idea that Earth is female, you know, because I don't know where you said it, but there was this part where she says Earth and then blah, 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 blah. She refers to Earth as she. So,
yeah, we see the devastation of the Earth and her beings by the corporate warriors.
Yeah. So, I think what for me is missing here is, on like a philosophical level, the reflection about the fact that this construction of Earth as she is already a patriarchal construct, you know?
Yes.
So this is what I'm missing here also.
Well, and it seems to be an attempt to kind of merge the cultural ecofeminism and the radical ecofeminism in her discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to consider those a little more critically.
Yeah.
And understand how we can parse them out and
Yeah.
So But that was another kind of strain of kind of 80s ecofeminism. And Esther King is she's written a lot about ecofeminism throughout the 80s and further on. In her 2011 essay on the state of ecofeminist research, Greta Gard points to numerous texts as foundational to the movement, including Susan Griffin's Women in Nature from 78 and Carolyn Merchant's The Death of Nature in 1980. In Women in Nature, Griffin presents a, quote, exploration of the ways that the feminized status of women, animals, nature, and feminized others, children, people of color, farmers, slaves, as well as the body itself, emotions, and sexuality, have been conceived of as separate and inferior in order to legitimate their subordination under an elite and often violent and militarized male-dominated social order. So she really kind of pulls it apart and says, like, these things have been identified as inferior or subordinated and are being, and violence is being committed against them.
Mm-hmm.
Merchant, Carolyn Merchant, bridges socialist feminist and socialist feminism and ecology in Death of Nature, which provides kind of historical documentation for the claim that the domination of women and nature have shared roots in the logic of science and capitalism and the intertwining of economics and rationalism, which she traces from like 1484 to 1716. So she looks at how racism, speciesism, sexism, colonialism, and capitalism are historically connected with the racist and colonialist voyages of discovery that resulted in appropriating indigenous peoples, animals, and land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what I also find interesting about, you know, the fact that women as a construct is usually associated much more closely with nature than man as a construct.
Yes.
This is also something that white people do with other cultures or other ethnic groups, like indigenous people. You know, this romanticization of indigenous people that, of course, is the flip side of their oppression.
Yes.
Romanticization as like the quote-unquote noble savage that is kind of closer to nature than white people are, blah 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 blah. I think there are very similar strategies at play here, and what I like about ecofeminism, or that particular brand of ecofeminism, is that it kind of points out the similarities of those constructs and how kind of the subjugation of nature is linked to the subjugation of women and linked to the subjugation of everything that's not considered male or man, and how that is linked to the subjugation of, for example, indigenous people. So that's what I like about it, is that it shows us the underlying structures of thought.
Yeah, I agree. Another thing that she really looks at is the 3 centuries of European witch burnings that eradicated women herbalists and midwives, along with their animal familiars.
Mm-hmm.
And so these historical moments are really juxtaposed against like animal experimentation, the demise of midwifery, the rise of Western medical science. Mm-hmm. All of which function as really illicit appropriations of self-determination, power, and wealth from indigenous women, indigenous people, women, queers, animals, and nature to elite men. So all of these kind of things from this historical perspective, she then juxtaposes against kind of our contemporary moment and how this much larger corporate and often male-directed, certainly capitalist, history has led to the exploitation of indigenous peoples, animals, women, land, etc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then finally, Gard explains how Mary Daly's gyn slash ecology, like gynecology, like gynecological, but also it's a play on words. If you see it, you'll understand.
Yeah. I think they've got it.
Yeah, okay. From 1978, exposed the historical and cross-cultural persecution of women as legitimized by the various male-dominated institutions of religion, culture, and medical science. And she specifically looks at like the Indian suti, Chinese foot binding, African genital mutilation, European witch burnings, American gynecology, and Nazi medicine. And she links them with the physical health of women and the environment, with the recuperation of women-centered language and thought.
Yeah. And a lot of that might not make sense when you hear it like condensed in one sentence,
yes,
as you did just now, because it sounds like a lot, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, read it. It actually makes sense. You might be critical about some aspects of it, but she's got a point.
Yeah, sure. Outside the U.S., Gard briefly mentions early German and Australian ecofeminists like Maria Mies and Ariel Soleil, mm-hmm. Who were, you know, kind of writing in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And she points to a few reasons why ecofeminism did not become the third wave of feminism that many had anticipated it would become.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole article is really great. And she's actually pretty prolific in terms of ecofeminist literature. But one of the things that she explains is that cultural ecofeminisms focus on, quote, the celebration of goddess spirituality and the critique of patriarchy advanced in cultural ecofeminism.
Mm-hmm.
Post-structuralist and other third wave feminists portrayed all ecofeminisms as an exclusively essentialist equation of women with nature, discrediting ecofeminism's diversity of arguments and standpoints to such an extent that by 2010, it was nearly impossible to find a single essay, so much less a section, mm-hmm. devoted to issues of feminism and ecology, and certainly not ecofeminism. So this focus on spirituality and women connected with the earth and all of that, that became so problematic for so many other feminists and strains of feminism that there was very little scholarship that was being produced on it, at least certainly not calling itself ecofeminism, even if it was ecofeminist. Yeah.
But that's also a very reductive understanding of ecofeminism.
Oh, yeah, right here. Sure.
And the celebration of goddess spirituality is something that by no means all ecofeminists said. It was a small section of ecofeminists that also
Absolutely.
Had this spiritual aspect to it.
But the problem was that it became problematic enough for other tight strains of feminism that they just wanted to ignore ecofeminism altogether because they didn't want to deal with that.
With that, yeah. So just one question. What article by Gard did you quote here?
That is a great question. The article is... Oh, wait, where did it go? I had two articles by Emily Gard. The first is from 2011, and this is the one that I'm quoting. It's from Feminist Formations, and it is Ecofeminism Revisited, Rejecting Essentialism and Replacing Species in the Material Feminist Environmentalism. And mm-hmm. the other article that I looked at from hers is from 2010, and it's called New Directions in for Ecofeminism Toward a More Feminist
mm-hmm.
Eco-Criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a strain of eco-criticism that is not necessarily feminist, and she's looking at ways that we can kind of revisit ecofeminism and eco-criticism and find a way to bring them together that is really focused on this radical ecofeminism rather than cultural ecofeminism.
Yeah, rather than the essentialist variety of it.
Exactly.
And I love seeing that there are people who write ecofeminist things now. I mean, it's not now. It was 2010, 2011 that those articles were published. But it's rather recent.
Yeah.
And that's very important because, you know, we are dealing globally with a very, what's the word? Jesus Christ, the heat is killing my brain. And I had to turn my fan off because it's too loud for the recording. So, yeah, we are in a very precarious situation right now globally with the climate crisis.
Yeah.
So I think now more than ever, ecofeminism is an important, perspective of analysis, especially also in a world in which those people, and they're mostly men right now, who are the most important actors when it comes to attacking women's rights mm-hmm. and LGBT rights and human rights in general are also the people who just deny mm-hmm. that there is a problem with the climate, you know? It's the same people that we fight against, so it makes sense.
Well, and there's been a lot more focus recently, I would say, in academic scholarship on the Anthropocene, which is the period of time influenced by human beings.
Yeah.
So you'll see a lot of scholarship, a lot of conferences having to do with that. it's important that there be a feminist lens put into that discussion as well. And that's what ecofeminism does for us.
Yeah.
The other thing that you see a lot of more recently, I would say, in, or at least within the last 10 years, I've seen an increase in animal studies, in especially in literary studies, but also in kind of more humanities, liberal arts research. And I think that that's also very interesting. And it's not just, you know, and we'll talk about veganism in a bit here, but it's not just that. It's also how animals are portrayed in literature, how they're portrayed in through different time periods, and what that tells us about the literature itself, the society, etc. The last thing I'll say about the, you know, state of ecofeminism, at least by, you know, 2011, was that Charisse Thompson, who reflected that, quote, post-structuralist feminisms somehow lost sight of the structuralist insight of ecofeminism that yoked together world patterns of environmental degradation with women's oppression. So they completely like blocked that out and the, and just kind of moved on from it. And it's still important to how we consider our discussions of environmental disaster and how what's causing that environmental disaster and how we can approach it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a not so short background on some aspects of ecofeminism.
Well, there you have it. A comprehensive summary of everything ecofeminist happening from Emma Goldman to 2011. You know everything now.
And we are being very sarcastic because that is not at all everything. But it gives us a tasting, a sense of some of the stuff that's out there.
And also we always have to verbally indicate that we are sarcastic, because if we don't, people will write us and take us seriously.
Yes.
And mansplain about how we should talk to each other.
Yes.
Okay, carry on. So Liz already said a few words about veganism and feminism and vegetarian ecofeminism. And I kind of, when, so the idea of doing an episode about ecofeminism was Liz's idea originally. And when she said she wanted to do the topic, the first thing that came to my mind was the whole issue of vegetarianism and veganism and feminism. So this is what I wanted to talk about. I don't know exactly if that's really a huge aspect of ecofeminism, but it's one that is very important to me personally. So this is why, this is what I'm going to talk about today.
Because what's the point of having your own podcast if you can't talk about the shit that you want to talk about?
Exactly. It's my fucking podcast. So I'm going to say whatever the fuck I want. So deal with it. So veganism and feminism is usually talked about in the context of ecofeminism, but we could just as well talk about it in the context of intersectional feminism and intersectionality. And of course, ecofeminism and intersectional feminism are also very intertwined, so it probably doesn't make much sense to maybe even label different types of feminism sometimes, but here we go. So the concept of intersectionality, when we say it, or when we talk about intersectional feminism, or the need to for feminism to be intersectional, we usually mean that we need to include in our analysis of gender also an analysis of race and or class, or that we also need to include that in our political thinking, in our political activism, in our strategies. So now there are also feminists, including myself, that argue that we also should include the idea of species.
Yes.
Sometimes also the construct of nature, culture, into analysis and political thinking and action. Or as Wikipedia puts it, quote, through the feminist concept known as intersectionality, it is recognized that sexism, racism, classism, and other forms of interhuman oppression are all connected, based on the same structure of oppression and on similar strategies of exploitation. Vegetarian ecofeminism aims to include the domination of not only the environment, but also of non-human animals to the list, because remember, humans are an animal species.
Yes, we are. We are. We too are animals.
Yes. A major theme within ecofeminism generally is the belief that there is a strong connection between the domination of women and the domination of nature. We already heard about that. And that must be eradicated in order to end oppression. Also in this context, again, we should add that ecofeminism also either explicitly or implicitly associates patriarchy with capitalism and capitalist exploitation.
Yes.
So this variety of ecofeminism or intersectional feminism argues that non-males and non-humans are oppressed. They're oppressed in different ways, but they're oppressed on the same basis, on the basis of the same type of societal structure and on the same type of patriarchal exploitative system, whatever. So, and that all of that is inextricably linked to capitalism, that capitalism is inextricably linked to the exploitation of quote-unquote nature, or what we construct as nature in order to be able to exploit it, and to the exploitation of non-human animals. So there is a link between the continuing subjugation of women and the human domination of nature. In other words, the fact that in a patriarchal culture, both women in a figurative and animals on the literal level are considered meat is not a coincidence. Before I talk about this in more detail, I want to kind of include my own personal story, because I started reading feminist literature and actively identifying as a feminist at around 14. At around the age of 14. And before that, I remember that I held very strong feminist convictions, but I didn't really know that they were feminist because I didn't know what the word feminist meant, nor did I come in contact with feminist writing or thinking what a feminist. So I think I've always been a feminist in a sense, particularly because I've always been someone who has a very strong sense of justice. But I never identified as a feminist because I simply didn't know what that was. So, but around 14, I started reading up on subjects, on issues of gender equality and feminism and all of that. So, and then I started identifying as a feminist. And that happened at the same time that I went vegan. So for me, because, you know, that time for me was a time where I kind of was politicized in a sense. And so for me, my feminist identification and my choice to not want to exploit or harm animals are very, very closely connected. And I don't even really know how to think or feel about the one thing without thinking about the other. For me, that's kind of, very closely intertwined. And also, full disclosure, I was a very strict vegan for over 10 years. Now I'm 99% vegan, with the occasional G's happening, especially when I'm stressed out. But I still very strongly believe in veganism. And So there you go. Liz, are you still there?
I'm still here. I'm just listening.
Okay. Okay, good. I didn't hear you. I was like, oh God, the connection.
No, I'm okay. Still here. No, okay, I mean, we talked about this when I was in Vienna. I mean, you can get, like, people talk about being vegan as though it's a struggle and it's something that, you know, is so hard to do. And I think in some places it's very hard to do. But if it's your politics, if it's a part of your identity, you want to make the effort to do that. And like even with cheese, like you can find a place that treats their animals well and where, you know, the cheese making is done in an ethical way.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean,
yeah, sure.
I think that still, even if it's done in an, I mean, the question is what is ethical in that context? Because in order to produce meat, you have to impregnate a cow and take away the calf and then take them the milk from the cow. So I'm not sure if that's really true. I mean,
have you ever eaten vegan cheese?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
And how do you feel about vegan cheese?
I think it's nothing to do with cheese. there are some, I mean, there are some vegan cheeses that I like, but not as cheese, because it's something completely different to me.
Okay.
And that's the problem that I have with veganism at the moment, is that cheese really is the only thing that you cannot substitute. It's the only thing. For me, like, I eat, like, most of the time I eat vegan. As I said, it's just sometimes I eat cheese. Mm-hmm. Because for all the other things, like, I don't know, yogurt, milk, whatever, I even prefer the vegan version most of the time.
Okay.
I don't, you know, there's nothing I miss other than cheese. It's the only thing.
Okay.
So, yeah. For me, one of the most influential writers, and this is why I want to kind of focus on her today, is Carol J. Adams. Again, I said this is a very personal thing. This is who was really important for me, both in my veganism and feminism. And I would like to introduce you to her work, because while a lot of what I said about vegetarian feminism might sound very theoretical, once you read her stuff, it becomes very tangible, at least for me it did. And a lot of what she wrote in the 90s might not be as current now as it was back then. So, I mean, of course, a lot of feminist thinking and writing happened since then, and there might be a lot of stuff in her books that you find problematic, you know, because it's almost 30 years later now.
Sure.
But I think a lot of things that she writes about are still very relevant, even though there are problematic aspects to it. Yeah, so I read two of her books in her teens, and the one was The Sexual Politics of Meat and The Pornography of Meat. And that's the two books that I will mostly talk about. And also, by the way, I will post a few images on Instagram for the part where I talk about The Pornography of Meat, because in that case, it's also necessary to have certain visuals to understand what I'm talking about, because she very much talks about the aspect of visual objectification of women and how it relates to animal abuse. And it's necessary to see that when we talk about visual mm-hmm. things, to actually have pictures in front of you. So Carol G. Adams was born in New York, in New York State, in 1951. And she's a writer, a feminist, and animal rights advocate. She attended the University of Rochester, where she majored in English and history. And as an undergraduate, she was involved in bringing women's studies courses to the university's course catalog. So, yay. She graduated there with a BA in 1972 and obtained her Master of Divinity from Yale Divinity School in 1976. And she also studied in Boston with Mary Daly, who we already talked about, who wrote Gyne Ecology. And Carol T. Adams is also a pioneer of feminist care theory in animal ethics. And she, together with Josephine Donovan, she edited a reader called The Feminist Care Tradition in Animal Ethics. I will not talk about this in detail today, but like feminist care ethics is a whole huge topic in feminist theory. And it's been for a while. And Josephine Donovan and Carol T. Adams kind of brought an animal-human relationship perspective into the whole feminist care ethics debate. So Adams recalls how she's turned into vegetarian the following way. She said she discovered the dead body of her pony that was killed in a hunting accident. And then the same day for dinner, the family ate hamburgers. And she kind of concluded that it was hypocritical for her to mourn the death of her pony, and then on the other hand, have no problem eating a slaughtered cow. And that was the moment where she turned a vegetarian.
I didn't have a pony. Because no, but yeah. When I was, I want to say 5 years old, and I was just talking to my parents about this story the other day, because it's kind of a family story at this point. But I was like five, and we were driving, and it was kind of in the countryside, and there were cows, and I was just like 5 year olds do, like musing about mm-hmm. life, and I said, Dad, how do they get enough cows to die so that we have enough meat? Like, how do they plan that? That the cows are like old enough that they're going to die so that we have meat to eat. And my dad was like really honest with me, which is surprising because normally people are not that honest with 5 year olds.
He says,
well, actually, if a cow dies, we don't eat that meat because they were probably sick. They have to kill the cows. God. And I was appalled. And I refused to eat meat for like a week, but I was five. So like, I didn't I wasn't like 14 and like getting into like feminist and like, you know, ecofeminism. Yeah. I was five and like wanted a hamburger a week later. But in my mind, like I just didn't understand how we had, like why we had to kill cows. Like, why can't they just die and we can eat their meat? So that's my, that's my childhood story about understanding where meat production, where meat comes from.
And I think that's the case for many children. I think for children, it's just a horrible idea that you have to kill animals in order to eat them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And a lot of, and I will get into that a bit later, but a lot of feminist thought or ecofeminist thought also says, why do we then, as grown-ups, kind of disconnect from that empathic, empathetic reaction? Why don't we listen to that, you know? But, you know, the way that I became, because I turned vegan at the age of, I was almost 15, so 14, mm-hmm. 15. But I turned vegetarian when I was 12. And I didn't even know, just as I was a feminist before I knew what a feminist was, I was a vegetarian before I knew what a vegetarian was, because sure. I just refused to eat meat. And the reason why I stopped eating meat was that I grew up in a very small village in Lower Austria, and our neighbors had pigs. They were farmers. They had pigs. And I still remember, like, seeing the small baby pigs and I didn't understand that those pigs were held to be eaten later on. I just thought that they were like pets, you know, mm-hmm. because as a child, they're just animals that, I don't know, it's just, for me, they were just pets. And then sure. I remember that every once in a while, there was this huge animal transport, like, van. What's the word? Like the... Tiertransporter? How do you call that in English?
Like a animal transport truck. I mean, we don't really have a good... I'm sure there's a word for it. I am not from a farm community. I don't understand this.
So the truck that comes to take the animals
yeah.
and take them to the slaughterhouse came every once in a while. And as a child, it was always very early in the morning. I remember that because I was always lying in bed, and the window of the room that I slept in was kind of that window was on the side of where the pigs were kept. So it was kind of, there was just a street in between my window and the, Jesus Christ, what's going on with my brain?
The pen?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like where the pigs were kept. There was just a street. Yeah, so you get what I mean. There was just a street between that, so I could hear everything. And so, yeah, it was always very early in the morning, and I heard this big truck coming, and then I heard the pigs screaming, and they were just screaming in panic. And I knew that they were panicking, because, I mean, it's just a horrible thing to experience, you know, and you kind of feel their pain and their panic, and it's just, yeah, it was really bad. And I always like kind of put my blanket over my head so that I didn't hear it. And I never understood why that happened. And there was a point where I then understood why that happened. And the reason was that we wanted to eat the meat. And once I understood that, I think it took a bit of time until I then made the decision that I don't want to eat it anymore. But so that was the original kind of impetus for me to stop eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I, yeah, and at 12, I did stop eating meat. So, yeah, so I think many, many children have that very emotional connection to animals and this very empathetic reaction to their pain, and mm-hmm. also don't understand why, if we have to kill animals to eat them, why do we do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And many children, at least for a while, refuse to eat meat after they realize that. So I've heard those stories from so many people. So okay, but back to the topic. So Carol G. Adams very, very prominently wrote the book The Sexual Politics of Meat, A Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory. And it's the book when it comes to feminist vegetarianism. It was published in 1990. And there are different arguments that are articulated in the book. And it's very complex. And I suggest you read it because, yeah, I will just give you an introduction. So she says, first, in our culture, there is a connection between meat or meat eating and masculinity. So in hindsight, I would also argue what Adam talks about here is what Connell later calls hegemonic masculinity, because of course there are different types of masculinities, but it was 1990, remember that. So she says there is a connection between meat eating and masculinity. There is a connection on a conceptual level, because meat eating is associated with masculinity, while salad, fruits, vegetable eating is associated with femininity.
Sure. I mean, men went out and hunted meat, women collected plants and berries.
That's the idea. Yeah, that's the idea. And that also doesn't really halt.
No.
Like, that's not really, I mean, if we really look into the research on that subject, that's not really the case. No. But that's the idea that we have of our past, is that the men were the hunters. And then Adams also argues that vegetables or plant-based food is devalued as food because it's associated with femininity. So meat is proper, food because it's associated with masculinity. And veganism or vegan food is for quote-unquote pussies, you know what I mean? So, and I say that very deliberately because it has three different levels of meaning, and all three are very accurate in that context. And you will probably understand later on why I said it that way. So there is this idea of virility, that a man needs his meat. And she also says that, on the other hand, there is this anxiety surrounding veganism because veganism or vegetarianism destabilizes hegemonic masculinity. Mm-hmm. In The Sexual Politics of Meat, she has many, many examples from literature and art to trace that connection of men and masculinity and meat eating. And it's really fascinating. And then what she also says is that in a patriarchal culture, literal meat, which is the bodies of animals, and figurative meat, which is the bodies of women, are both there for man's consumption. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that he is kind of the hunter that hunts for his prey and consumes the meat that he hunts down. In our languages, there is a lot of very telling metaphors that link both the figurative sexual consumption of women's bodies, mm-hmm, and the literal consumption of animals' bodies, which is also very fascinating, but that, you know.
Well, and we talked about this in our sex positive feminism episode as well, yeah, that, you know, we have this image of men being the ones that go out and, you know, in order to be a real man, you have to consume sex, basically. And
yeah.
I mean, the language itself just translates very directly to meat eating.
Yeah. And then she writes, quote, "In some respects, we all acknowledge the sexual politics of meat. When we think that men, especially male athletes, need meat, or when wives report that they could give up meat, but they fix it for their husbands, the overt association between meat eating and
virile
maleness is enacted. It is the covert associations that are more elusive to pinpoint, as they are so deeply embedded within our culture." And then, meat and masculinity is also connected on a practical level, not just on a conceptual level, because many more women than men are vegetarians and vegans, and men consume more meat than women do. And what she also talks about, which I also find interesting, is that often in history and throughout different cultures, meat was reserved for men because it was considered the best food, especially in times of shortage when women left meat to the men. Okay, so then there's a second argument in there. And that's a very important concept in the book, which is the concept of the absent referent. So she argues that animals disappear from our consciousness in order for us to be able to consume them as food. She writes, quote, "Behind every meal of meat is an absence, the death of the animal whose place the meal takes. This is the absent referent. The absent referent functions to cloak the violence inherent to meat eating, to protect the conscience of the meat eater, and render the idea of individual animals as immaterial to anyone's selfish desires. It is that which separates the meat eater from the animal, and the animal from the end product. The function of the absent referent is to keep our meat separated from any idea that she or he was once an animal."
This is really interesting, because it definitely connects up with a lot of the kind of local food movements that you, mm-hmm, hear about in the United States especially, but I think that they're kind of more global now, but that we don't know where our food comes from. Mm-hmm. That we go to the grocery store, it's packaged in plastic and styrofoam containers, and we don't have a sense of where the actual meat comes from. And yeah, if you're willing to eat meat, then you should be willing to see how the meat is broken down, how an animal is killed, and all of that. Like, if that's something that you want to be able and willing to eat, then you need to be able to see and understand and quote unquote stomach the entire process.
Yeah.
And then, like, you have a sense of where your meat comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. I will talk about this later because another writer that is very, very recent, her name is Melanie Joy, published a book, I think, in 2016. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know the date, but it's very recent, and it's called Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. Mm. And she talks about exactly that. And I will go into detail on that more later. But the whole, like the quote from Carol G. Adams ends with, "The function of the absent referent is to keep our meat separated from any idea that she or he was once an animal, to keep something from being seen as having been someone, to allow for the moral abandonment of another being." So she argues that animals disappear in three ways. So mm-hmm. the first way is they disappear literally because they are killed. The second way is their bodies disappear because they are cut up, reshaped, etc. And then the third way, and that's interesting, they disappear conceptually because we rename them. Mm-hmm. And then we take their oppression and use it as a metaphor for other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even from and the level of language, I think that's really interesting because we talk about cows as cows, but when we talk about their meat, then it's beef.
Yes.
Yes. And chicken, you know, we talk about poultry or, yep. you know, whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, but especially I would say especially with beef and maybe with pork, you know, yeah. we don't talk about pigs. We talk about pork. Mm-hmm. And I think in German, it's a little more directly related to the animal. Mm-hmm. Because when you're talking yeah. about a pig, it's Schwein, and then Schweinefleisch is like yeah, pig yeah, yeah, flesh.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's maybe a more direct connection to the actual animal. But then when you talk about cuts of meat or how it's prepared, you talk about how it's cooked into a hamburger. Hamburger mm-hmm. has no relation to beef at all or yeah. or cows. Like,
yeah. And then what I find very interesting is that we not only rename the meat, but when she says we take their oppression and use it as a metaphor for other things. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the part where it also relates to the oppression of women.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the ways that we talk about animals and meat eating is also the ways that we talk about women and also the quote unquote sexual sexualization and objectification of women.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's kind of the third part of her argument when she says that women are absent reference in our patriarchal culture and that feminism is the response to that. So she says that male dominance and animals' oppression are linked by the way that both women and animals function as absent reference in meat eating and dairy production, and that feminist theory logically contains a vegan critique. Just as veganism covertly challenges patriarchal society, patriarchy is a gender system that is implicit in human-animal relationships. She then goes on to say that there is sort of a trinity of forces. So, first of all, there is objectification, and she defines objectification as the process by which we see another being, not as someone anymore, but something. Mm-hmm. Then there is fragmentation. So the cutting up of a body or a being, again, in the case of animals, literally, in the case of women, figuratively. And that's an aspect that she will discuss in more detail than in her book, The Pornography of Meat, later on. And then there's consumption, where we consume that being. And she again says, we literally consume animals, we visually consume women. And on her homepage, she says, the sexual politics of meat shows how a process of objectification, fragmentation, and consumption enables the oppression of animals so that animals are rendered beingless through technology, language, and cultural representation. Objectification permits an oppressor to view another being as an object. Once objectified, a being can be fragmented. Once fragmented, consumption happens. The consumption of a being and the consumption of the meaning of that being's death, so that the referent point of meat changes. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And then she also says that veganism is a nonverbal refusal of a patriarchal world and that veganism expresses a feminist perspective. So she says, an overlap of cultural images of sexual violence against women and fragmentation and dismemberment of nature and the body in Western culture exists. This cycle of objectification, fragmentation, and consumption links butchering with both the representation and reality of sexual violence in Western cultures that normalizes sexual consumption. This structure creates entitlement to abuse with the structure of the absent referent, the states of objectification and fragmentation disappear and the consumed object is experienced without a past, without a history, without biography, and without individuality. Mm-hmm. The sexual politics of meat offers examples of historical, contemporary, and fictional resistance to meat eating and argues that food decisions are coded ways of resistance. For many progressive feminist radical activists, vegetarianism was one aspect of their activism. And then one thing that she also talks about she calls it feminized protein, mm-hmm. Which is the protein produced by female animals, like yeah. milk and eggs. And I think this is also a very interesting aspect of the whole debate, because while we eat, apart from meat eating, like also the consumption of eggs and milk and dairy products, what we do is we exploit female animals' reproductive capabilities.
Yeah, what's so fascinating about that is a lot of people who are vegetarians will say, oh, mm-hmm. but I eat like milk and eggs. Mm-hmm. which, you know, I'm not judging at all. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to go from a like feminist vegan, feminist eco-critical perspective on this, that's precisely the things that you should not be excluding, because those are things that literally exploit female animals.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly also like their reproductive capabilities.
Yes.
It's really like, yeah. And that's also something a lot of people don't know, I think. A lot of people, when I talk to them, seem to think that cows, for example, just give milk. Like, it just happens. They just produce it.
Well, it's not like cow shit. Like, it's not.
No. No.
It's not like piss. Manure. Like that. Okay. Cows always produce manure. Like, okay, I'm fine using manure to like grow crops and stuff. But yeah. like, if you're really concerned about the like eco-feminist aspect of vegetarianism and veganism, like, I mean, these are things you need to understand. Oh, God, there's a hilarious story. Do you know the story about mayonnaise?
What? No.
Okay. So there's a vegan woman. I don't know if this is a real story, but this was posted on social media within the last couple of weeks. So vegan woman goes into a Subway, which is a sandwich shop. She gets a vegetarian sandwich, and she says, you know, oh, he asks if she wants cheese. She says, no, I'm vegan. And she says to put all the vegetables on it and some mayonnaise.
Yeah.
And he goes to put the mayonnaise on, and he thought that she was kidding. And yeah. she said, like, no, I always get mayonnaise. And he said, well, I just assumed you were joking because you're vegan, because it's got eggs in it. And she didn't know what to do with this information, because she had no idea that mayonnaise had eggs in it.
Oh, okay.
So she just had him put the mayonnaise on it and was like lost, like totally destroyed. Like, she just didn't know how to process the fact that like she had been vegan, but had been eating mayonnaise that had eggs in it.
Oh, no.
And like her like mind just kind of shut down. So, yeah, I mean, you need to know about the food you're eating. You need to know what's in the food you're eating, if that's something that's important to you.
That's very good vegan mayonnaise, thank God.
Oh, I love mayonnaise. Sure.
But the thing is, cows give milk because they are forcibly impregnated. Like, continuously.
Well, cows give milk because they are pregnant, just like women give milk when they are pregnant. I don't have milk because I have never had children. But in the industrial milk production that we have, cows are forcibly like impregnated so that they can produce more
milk.
Which
is horrible.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Which is horrible. So I really don't understand how you can be a feminist and not have a problem with that, because I don't want to say it's rape, because that's such a human concept, but I.
But I mean, if we're putting on our like eco-feminist lens, it's speciesist to say that cows can't be raped.
Yeah.
Because it's rape is about power, and we have power over those animals, and we are exploiting that power to forcibly impregnate them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So what Wikipedia says about the sexual politics of meat is, In The Sexual Politics of Meat, Adam parallels the patriarchal system with the relationship between humans and animals. The male connotations associated with meat eating not only highlight species inequality, but also defines distinct gender roles. Simply, meat signifies male dominance over females. Adam proclaims that our culture has become preoccupied with reducing non-human animals to a source of consumption. A fragmentation of the individual species. A recurring theme throughout her work is that men feel a sense of entitlement over animals similar to men who abuse, exploit, or degrade women for their bodies. And what I found very interesting about her homepage is that she also has a section titled The Sexual Politics of Meat in the Trump Era, which I would suggest you look at. It's really interesting. So, yeah, then there's a text that I haven't read, which is called Animals and Women, Feminist Theoretical Explorations, in which she argues that the social context behind female oppression and sexual violence has a direct tie to the way humans mistreat other species. So humans tend to deem animals as an inferior, quote-unquote, species because it's a number of species. But yeah, we usually do not think of humans as just another animal species. And then also justify their actions regarding animal exploitation. So according to Adams, men regard women in a similar light. Mm-hmm. And this sense of entitlement over animals translates into human relations. And men begin to label women as inferior as well as available for abuse, just as animals. So and the established discourse shifts from a negative image for non-human animals to a sexist portrayal of women. Constantly, men refer to women using language that you'd also use for dogs, for chicks, for bunnies, mm-hmm. Which all indicate men using women as mere means, because those animals are also means, yeah. Right? So, and this is why I said veganism is for pussies, because women are referred to as pussies, as bitches, as chicks, as bunnies, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, given current speciesism, individuals use non-human animals for their production, for example, cows for milk, hens for eggs, or female dogs to breed more puppies. And humans use chicks as simply physical beings, similar to how men may exploit the female body just for pleasure. And we use the term speciesism again and again, and just as an explanation, the concept of speciesism was coined similar to racism or sexism, mm-hmm. to explain the ways that different species are treated differently, yeah. And some are oppressed and some are not, and blah, 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 blah. So it's about the hierarchies between,
between different species. It does relate back to whether they're predator and prey type of hierarchy as well. Like we tend to have as pets animals that are often, you know, prey, like mice and rabbits and things like that. But then we also have dogs and cats, which we've domesticated to the point that they could no longer be predators. So, and sadly, this gets tied to like biblical discourses. Where I'm never going to be able to tell you what a passage this is, but it's basically that like men, humans should have dominion over the earth to like do with it as they please. Yeah. But there's two ways of viewing that, right? We need to be stewards of the earth and protect it and make sure that like we're not exploiting it. Or you can translate it as we need to be like exploiting the earth and using it for our own ends. So from the biblical perspective, you could either be a protector of the earth and animals or an exploiter of the earth or animals.
You can be the caretaker or you can be the exploiter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and yeah, of course, speciesism usually refers to the fact that speciesism refers to the fact that humans don't consider themselves as animals and mm-hmm. that they completely oppress other animals, mm-hmm. right? Then there's also the book by Carol T. Adams that's called The Pornography of Meat, and that ties in with what we talked about in the last episode. So up to this point, you probably noticed that some of her arguments tie in very well with kind of second wave feminism and radical feminism, mm-hmm. because she talks a lot about sexualization of female bodies and how that is related to meat consumption. And she probably is what some people would call a sex negative feminist. We kind of deconstructed that concept last time, yeah. So I wouldn't agree with that. But just so you know, that there's also a lot of criticism against her, of course. And also the way that she defines pornography more implicitly than explicitly is also important to understand, I think, because, as I said, it's very much in line with second wave feminism, in that she defines pornography as kind of violent objectification, fragmentation, and consumption of the female body within patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not... She probably... And if you haven't listened to our last episode, then go back and listen to that. She probably would not define feminist pornography as pornography. Right?
Yeah.
She would... You know, she has this very, like, radical feminist, second wave feminist understanding of pornography.
Yeah.
And she argues that women are animalized and that animals are feminized, and through that feminization, often sexualized too.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably difficult to understand, but I will put a few, like, visuals on Instagram so that you can understand it. Think about the way that meat is marketed and the way we talk about female body parts.
Mm-hmm.
Often we use the very same language. So first of all, I already said that we talk about women very often in animal terms, but we also talk about female body parts as kind of delicious, consumable kind of meat bits, mm-hmm. you know? And then on the other hand, meat is a lot of times also marketed in a way that it refers to exactly that sexualization of female body parts.
Mm-hmm.
And on her homepage, there are very interesting examples, more recent examples than in her book. So I actually have the politics of, both the politics of meat, textual politics of meat and pornography of meat in front of me right now. And on the cover of the pornography of meat, at least on the cover of the edition that I have here, there is an ad which is basically a burger, and the burger has female legs with, like, high heels.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says 100% pure beef. And those are the types of images that she kind of analyzes in the book. And as I said, on her homepage, she has more current examples. For example, there is an ad for chicken meat that says buns and thighs.
Ugh.
Which is a clear reference to the female body and the way the female body is sexualized. So yeah, again, so she says that women are animalized, and through that animalization, they are objectified, mm-hmm. and turned into consumable products. And then on the other hand, animals are also feminized, and through that feminization, also sexualized. And she calls that anthropopornography, and that's the sexualization Ooh. And feminization of animals. And it's also a particular form of hate speech against women.
Yeah.
Okay. And also one thing that she also, like, a particular variant of pictures that come up over and over again that she also has on her homepage is, like, the portrayal of pigs
mm-hmm.
As sexy women. Or, like, when people advertise pork, which is so absurd. And that's what she means when she says it's like the sexualization of animals, it's the objectification of women, it's hate speech against women, and at the same time it's both objectifying animals and women, actually, at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, in the pornography of meat, Adams draws the visual comparison between meat advertised on shelves and women portrayed in particular advertisements or magazines. So again, when she uses the term pornography, she doesn't refer to a particular variety of film, but she kind of means, when she says pornography, she means, like, violently objectifying discourse about
mm-hmm.
female bodies. Again, as I said, it's a very, like, second wave type of talking about pornography.
Yeah.
We must not kind of misunderstand it as pornography, as we understand it as, like, a type of film. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Sure.
So, yeah. So the idea of consumption plays a significant role in a culture that compares women to products. And it's important to note that consumption may refer to literal digestion or simply to a desire for someone considered attainable by another individual. She kind of juxtaposes those ads for meat with sexist and misogynistic images of women. And what she also does is she creates what she calls the A category, which is the idea of the white man. So she says there is, like, white male supremacy, mm-hmm. in civilized society, and the other to that A category is different races, non-human animals, and women. And she also argues that modern culture idealizes the white male figure and demonstrates that he represents an advanced civilized society. She argues that any individual who doesn't fall into this A category likely faces a reference to animals, now seen as derogatory and inferior, because, of course, before that, animals have been constructed as inferior mm-hmm. and as those that we can exploit. And in her work, she includes images of women labeled according to her body parts, similar to how a butcher advertises meat cuts. Mm-hmm. And the underlying premise remains the same. Current culture has created desire for consumption from non-human animals, genders, and races.
And this really goes back to the male gaze just that we were discussing yeah. in the last episode, that like the neutral position is the hetero white male, and we are told basically to see everything through his eyes, and so everything is targeted and marketed toward that gaze.
Yeah. And in the sexual politics of meat, she writes, dominance functions best in a culture of disconnect and fragmentation. Feminism recognizes connections. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then there's the concept of carnophilocentrism. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but I will put a link in the show notes if you're interested in that. Because if I start talking about that too, then we will talk for 5 hours instead of... Now we're already at 1:30, so yeah. I already introduced the name Melanie Joy, and she's a very recent psychologist and psychological researcher. So she has a very different approach to the whole subject, because most other ecofeminist writing has come from the perspective of humanities. And she really does psychological research. And she does research on the psychology of eating animals, which is just very fascinating. And I will, in the show notes, I will put a TED talk and another longer talk, which is really interesting. And in one of the talks, she tells a story. She says, imagine you're invited to a dinner, right? And you get like really delicious food. And then it's so good that you want to know the recipe. And then the cook tells you that the secret ingredient is, I don't know the amount, but like, golden retriever meat.
Oh.
And think about what your reaction would be, yeah. right? Because up to this point, you assumed that it's beef. Mm-hmm. And now you know it's golden retriever. But why is that a problem?
Sure.
Right? Why is the beef okay and the golden retriever meat isn't? And so her question basically is, why do we eat some animals and not others? Mm-hmm. As I said, her book is also called Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Workhouse. Mm-hmm. And while on a philosophical level, we would call that speciesism, on a psychological level, she calls that carnism. Mm-hmm. And she says, we don't see meat as dead animals. We consider dogs and cats as friends, but we eat the dead bodies of animals that are not very different from these cats and dogs. And they have feelings and they have lives that matter to them, just as the cats and dogs. For example, pigs are at least as intelligent as 3-year-old humans. They're more intelligent than dogs. And then also the types of animals that we eat, or that we are allowed to eat culturally, in our culture, that would be chicken, pigs, cows, or mm-hmm. some types of fish, right? And the types of animals that must not be eaten, which is, in our case, cats and dogs. Mm-hmm. That's culture specific.
Well, and it's more than just culture specific, because if you think about, you know, I always hear these stories about people who live on farms and they tell them not to name the animals, because once you start naming the animals and feeling a connection with the animals, yeah. then you don't want to kill them and you don't want to let them go yeah. to be able to mm-hmm. feed either your family, yeah. either by selling the meat or by actually eating the meat. So it makes it much more difficult.
Yeah.
And even, you know, if you look at post-war Europe, one of the easiest things to make as meat was rabbits, because they breed yes. so quickly. But people had rabbits, as, you know, they thought of them as often as pets. But because mm-hmm. there was no meat in the post-World War II time period, you know, people would breed rabbits. And then, mm-hmm. you know, you can't let the kids name the rabbits, because then you don't have any food. Mm. Or you yeah. can't, at least can't tell the children that the food that you have on the table is their pet rabbit.
Yeah. The point that she makes is that every culture considers their own choices to be rational and normal and natural. Mm-hmm. So we consider it normal and natural that we can eat cows and pigs. Mm-hmm. But if another culture eats dogs and cats, we think that's just barbaric and offensive and disgusting, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't make, I mean, rationally, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
So she says carnism is a type of conditioning that operates outside of our own awareness. So it's a normative framework that we grew up in. And it also happens outside of our conscious consent, because we never make the decision to eat meat, and we never make the decision to consciously consider some animals friends and some food, right? Mm-hmm. So we just eat meat because we learn to eat meat and we never question it. And as we said before, the moment children question it is very often the moment that they stop eating meat. So it's a decision that is made without our conscious consent. Mm-hmm. And it's a system of conditioning that enables us and makes us eat certain animals and then constructs that eating of animals as natural and normal. And her psychological research also focuses on this emotional disconnect that we don't see the victims, sort of. So we don't see how animals are turned into food.
Yeah.
This allows us to only see meat as meat and not as dead animals, right? Mm-hmm. Not dead individuals. And this is why we keep slaughterhouses out of sight, because we don't want to see them, or we feel that we would be emotionally unable to see what's going on, or to hear what's going on, or to smell what's going on. Because what is happening there is so horrible that we couldn't deal with it, right? It would be traumatizing. And yet we continue to consume the meat and the mm-hmm. animal products that are produced there. So we basically go against everything we think and feel is right in our daily lives, right?
But because we've been disconnected from the food, the source of our food for so long, yeah. we don't even think about it. I mean, it doesn't
exactly.
even...
Exactly. And that's the emotional disconnect that she kind of researches. And that's what she describes as carnism. And it's what Carol J. Adams calls absent referent, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a very similar way of thinking, but it's a different type of... So they're in different academic disciplines. So they have kind of different approaches to it. While the one is like coming from philosophy and humanities, the other is coming from psychological research, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah. That's why I also find Melanie Joy really interesting in that context. And what I find very important is like this questioning of norms that we grew up with, that we never question because we think it's natural and normal, but no, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't think I want to say much more than that. One person that you also already mentioned is Greta Gard. And what she did, she wrote a lot about queer ecofeminism too. So if you're interested in that, then look it up. She says that although many ecofeminists acknowledge that heterosexism is a problem, there is up to this point, or up to the point of her writing, there's been no systematic exploration of the potential intersections of ecofeminism and queer theories. Mm-hmm. And she kind of makes that in her article. So that's also very, very interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing I want to mention is intersectionality with veganism, because that's been something that has kind of, when we think of vegans, we think of kind of white hippies often.
Oh, yes.
But there has been an emergence of veganism, or maybe a resurgence. It's not really a resurgence, but a growth. Let's go with growth of veganism within the Black community, in the United States. And so, and some of it has to do with health, issues. You know, there's a health crisis, several health crises that are specific to kind of urban areas. And mm-hmm. the creation of food deserts and things like that. And so with an increase in vegetarian and veganism within the Black community, you have also an increase in, you know, accessible produce within Black communities that are not only affordable, but also, you know, filling in those spaces where there were food deserts and the only things that were available were processed foods. There's an article in the New York Times from 2017 that really focuses on the kind of growth of Black vegans for both environmental and social justice issues, but also because of health crises within the Black community in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we... There are a lot of critiques of ecofeminism. You know, one of the charges is that ecofeminism is kind of a white feminist savior complex thing. And that it's not intersectional enough and it doesn't include enough people of color. And I think, you know, to be sure, low-income communities and communities of color bear the greatest burden of environmental injustice. You know, where do people put factories that are going to screw up the water supply? In urban areas with people who are disadvantaged and they can't fight against those things. It's in
rural areas, not urban.
Well, in the United States, they put them in urban areas.
What, really?
Yeah, they do both in the United States.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at a place like...
Sorry, I thought you misspoke.
No, I did not.
I didn't know that they put... Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
No. No. I mean...
I wasn't aware of that. Okay.
When you have a community of people who have power, which are mostly middle class white people, they're able to say, we don't want this factory in our town. We don't want this. We don't want this thing that's going to pollute our air in our neighborhoods. And so it gets pushed into places where people have less political power, which sometimes, you know, can be... Sometimes it can be the countryside because someone's bought a piece of land there, but oftentimes it ends up being in more urban communities.
Okay.
Think, for example, of Flint, Michigan.
Oh, yes. They still don't have clean water, right?
Yeah, the Flint, Michigan issue isn't that there is a factory there. It's that political decisions were made to change the sources of their water in such a way that increased pollution. And there was a lack of infrastructure improvement in Flint, Michigan, so that there were lead pipes. So you have all of these things that are happening that are just taking advantage of an already disadvantaged community and just making the situation even worse.
Do we maybe want to explain for a second what happened in Flint? Because I think many people outside of the U.S. will probably not know what's going on.
What is still going on in Flint, Michigan? That the water is undrinkable in the city of Flint, Michigan, and that they have to drink bottled water, which is producing an even greater environmental problem?
Yeah. Yeah, and the reason for that is that didn't they do, like, what's the word? What's it called? Jesus Christ.
I don't know what you're talking about. What happened is they were getting their waters from one source, and the local government decided that they were going to change the source from which they were getting the water. But in doing so, it caused damage to, and I'm going to get some of this wrong, but there were issues with the pipes themselves. There was issues with the pollution in the water and the way that they were processing the water as it was going into the pipes. So all of these multiple problems meant that now they had to go in, they had to map out all of the pipes that were in the city to determine which ones were still older pipes that needed to be changed, which had not been done in years, many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. There was degradation of the pipes themselves. And they needed to, you know, process the water better. The water coming out of the taps in Flint, Michigan is discolored, it's full of chemicals, and it's undrinkable. But Flint, Michigan is primarily an area where we think of, you know, a lot of, has a large African American population, and people just didn't care.
Yeah, what I was thinking about, and I missed it because I remembered that wrong. I thought what happened in Flint was that they did this specific type of drilling, you know what I mean? Like this. Jesus Christ.
You're talking about fracking.
Yes! I'm talking about fracking.
No.
That's the word I was looking for.
The Flint, Michigan water situation is not because of fracking. That's in other areas.
Yeah, okay.
That's in places like Oklahoma, which they took a lot of land, particularly, you know, a large part of the population in Oklahoma is Native American. They found that they could do fracking in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Now we have earthquakes in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. a place that is not on a fault mm-hmm. line, a place that should not be having earthquakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other place where we see this happening is the oil spills that we have on Native American land because of oil pipelines that they pushed through, even though the Native Americans on that land protested them for months and months. Mm-hmm. The question is, how intersectional is the movement itself? Recent articles by individuals within ecofeminist communities and working on ecofeminist issues have pointed out the need to include low-income people and people of color, especially because they should be involved in the conversation about issues that directly impact them rather than being talked about. And there's, of course, the danger of making ecofeminism the answer to everything. But in this case, where the intersection of ecofeminism and social justice might be productive, we need to really talk about things like Flint, Michigan, mm. and the oil spills because of the oil pipelines. Things like that, that, you know, are corporations or government organizations taking advantage of people in disadvantaged areas for their own personal, political, and mm. economic gain. So that's, I mean, there's one, you know, ecofeminism could be seen as kind of a white savior complex thing, but we can also, you know, change that narrative too by including more people of color and really focusing on those communities that are being, that are the being particularly impacted by environmental disasters or catastrophes in the United States and elsewhere. I mean, if you look at something like Fukushima, yeah. even still Chernobyl, yeah. I mean, you still can't use the land in Chernobyl. You still can't live on that land. Mm-hmm. And that's because we were okay with, you know, nuclear energy and the dangers of that.
Yeah.
And we've already talked about the criticisms of ecofeminism from the perspective of looking at the essentialism and the women nature yeah. connection.
The question is it really essentialist or is it reacting to this essentialism and just working with what is there, you know?
And I think you can probably say both. I mean, there are certainly strains of ecofeminism that are more essentialist than others, but I think that the way that it has intersected with other forms of feminism and other theory heavy work has moved it more away from essentialism, pointed out the issues that the essentialism had and moved toward ecofeminism as something that is much more grounded in our understanding of patriarchy.
And I think, you know, just rejecting ecofeminism as a whole as essentialist is very, very reductive. And I think when we have like feminist debates, we have to allow for more nuanced perspectives than that.
Agreed. So yeah, that's ecofeminism.
That's ecofeminism. Period. The end.
And veganism and feminist veganism.
Everything. And you know everything.
Or if you don't, you can go to our website, which we have recently updated, though not all of the show notes are updated with all of our sources. So keep that in mind.
Not we. Well, Liz did it.
Yes.
Yeah, Liz redesigned our webpage. We still don't have all the content on there that we want to, but we will work on that in the next few weeks.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it looks much better now. It's much clearer. It's, you know, more organized. So,
and you can listen to all of our recent episodes from any place on the website.
Yes.
We've made that available for you.
Yes. And also, you can listen to us on your favorite podcast app. If you have the possibility to subscribe to us on that app, and if you have the possibility to rate and review, particularly on Apple Podcasts, you can do that. Then please take a few seconds. It doesn't really take long, and it makes a huge difference for us. So please do that.
And if you have any questions or comments, even if you want to criticize the sound of our voices, feel free to send us an email and tell us that. We appreciate those emails too.
Yes. Yeah. And then also, and our email address is shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook page that you can like, but we also have a Facebook group that you can join, which is there for, you know, if you want to discuss things with us, and you can do that also in the Facebook group. And actually, one of our listeners came up very recently with the idea that we should talk a bit more about books, about feminist like publications. And I was thinking one thing that would be great for the group, if you're interested in that, you could, and I'm talking specifically to Ina, who wrote us that email, if you want to, that would be a good place to start a She Who Persisted book club, you know?
Absolutely. I'd be all for that. I need more feminist books in my life.
So yeah, join the group, like the page, follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter @shepersistedpod. If you want to tell us something, then write us an email or pop us a line on Facebook or tweet at us. And if you want to support us, then please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes.
Or support us on Patreon.
And support us on Patreon, exactly. That also makes a huge difference. And yeah. Anything else?
I don't think so.
Well, then stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.
Bye.